I'm all right. I just get to thinking about things is all.
Yeah.
It don't help none, though, does it?
Nope.
They sat drinking their coffee. Troy shook out a cigarette and lit it and put his cigarettes and his Zippo lighter on the table. How come you had to stop back there?
I just did.
You said you had to.
Yeah.
What is it, some sort of religious thing?
No, it ain't nothing like that. It's just that the worst day of my life was one time when I was 17 years old, and me and my bud, my brother, we was on a run, and he was hurt, and there was a truckload of Mexicans just about like them back yonder appeared out of nowhere and pulled our bacon out of the fire. I wasn't even sure their old truck could outrun a horse, but it did. They didn't have no reason to stop for us, but they did. I don't guess it would have even occurred to them not to. That's all.
Troy sat looking out the window. Well, he said, that's a pretty good reason.
Well, it was all the one I needed anyways. You ready?
Yeah, he drained his cup. I'm ready. He paid his 2 pennies at the gate and pushed through the turnstile and went on across the bridge. On the banks of the river under the bridge, small boys held up 10 buckets nailed to the ends of poles and called out for money. He crossed the bridge into a sea of waiting vendors, hustling cheap jewelry, leather goods, blankets. They followed him along for a distance and were spelled by others in a relay of huckstering down Juarez Avenue and up Ignacio Mejia to Santos de Goyado, where they fell away and watched him go. He stood at the end of the bar and ordered a whiskey and propped his foot on the rail and looked across the room at the whores.
¿Dónde están sus compañeros? Said the barman.
He raised the glass of whiskey and turned it in his hand.
En el campo, he said.
He drank. He stood there for 2 hours. The whores came across the room one by one to solicit him, and one by one returned. He didn't ask about her. When he left, he'd had 5 whiskeys, and he paid for them with $1 and put $1 on top of it for the barman. He crossed Juarez Avenue and went limping up Mejia to the Napoleon and took a seat in front of the cafe and ordered a steak. He sat and drank coffee while he waited, and he watched the life in the streets. A man came to the door and tried to sell him cigarettes. A man tried to sell him a Madonna made of painted celluloid. A man with a strange device with dials and levers asked him if he wished to electrocute himself. After a while, the steak arrived. He went again the following night. There were 6 soldiers from Fort Bliss there, young recruits, their heads all but shaved. They eyed him drunkenly. They looked at his boots. He stood at the bar and drank 3 whiskeys slowly. She did not appear. He walked up Juarez Avenue through the hucksters and pimps. He saw boys selling stuffed armadillos. He saw a tourist, drunk, laboring up the sidewalk carrying a full suit of armor. He saw a beautiful young woman vomit in the street. Dogs turned at the sound and ran toward her. He walked up Tlaxcala and up Mariscal and entered another such place and sat at the bar. The whores came to tug at his arm. He said that he was waiting for someone. After a while, he left and walked back to the bridge.
This ends Disc 1, Cities of the Plain, Disc 2.
He had promised Mac he wouldn't ride the horse again until his ankle was better. Sunday after breakfast, he worked the animal in the corral, and in the afternoon he saddled Bird and rode up into the Harillas. Atop a raw rock bluff, he sat the horse and studied the country. The flooded salt flats shining in the evening sun 70 miles to the east. The peak of El Capitan beyond. All the high mountains of New Mexico paling away to the north beyond the red plains, the ancient creosote. In the steeply canted light, the laddered shadows of the fences looked like rail tracks running up the country, and doves were crossing below him toward a water tank on the McNew spread. He could see no cattle anywhere in that cow-trodden scrubland. The doves called everywhere, and there was no wind. When he got back to the house, it was dark, and by the time he'd unsaddled the horse and put it up and gone to the kitchen, Socorro had already cleared away and was washing the dishes. He got a cup of coffee and sat down, and she brought him his supper. And while he was eating, Mac came and stood in the hallway door and lit a cigar.
"You about ready?" he said.
"Yes, sir."
"Take your time. Take your time."
He walked back up the hallway. Socorro brought the pot from the stove and spooned the last of the caldillo onto his plate. She brought him more coffee and poured a cup for Mac and left it steaming on the far side of the table. When he was done eating, he rose and carried his plate and cup to the sink, and he poured more coffee, and then went to the old cherrywood press hauled overland in a wagon from Kentucky 80 years ago, and opened the door and took out the chess set from among the old cattlemen's journals and the half-bound ledgers and leather daybooks and the old green Remington boxes of shotgun shells and rifle cartridges. On the upper shelf, a dovetailed wooden box that held brass scale weights, a leather folder of drawing instruments, a glass horse carriage that once held candy for a Christmas in the long ago. He shut the door and carried the board and the wooden box to the table and unfolded the board and slid back the lid of the box and spilled out the pieces, carved walnut, carved holly, and set them up. Then he sat drinking his coffee. Mac came out and pulled back the chair opposite and sat and dragged the heavy glass ashtray forward from among the bottles of ketchup and hot sauce and laid his cigar in the ashtray and took a sip of the coffee. He nodded toward John Grady's left hand. John Grady opened his hand. He set the pawns on the board.
"I'm white again," said Mac.
"Yes, sir."
He moved his pawn forward. J.C. came in and got a cup of coffee from the stove and came to the table and stood.
"Sit down," said Mac. "You're making the room untidy." "That's all right. I ain't staying."
"Better sit down," said John Grady. "He needs all his powers of concentration."
"You got that right," said Mac.
J.C. sat down. Mac studied the board. J.C. glanced at the pile of white chess pieces at John Grady's elbow.
"Son, you better cut the old man some slack. You might could be replaced with somebody the cowboys better and plays chess worse."
Mac reached and moved his remaining bishop. John Grady moved his knight. Mac took up his cigar and sat, puffing quietly. He moved his queen. John Grady moved his other knight and sat back. "Check," he said. Mac sat, studying the board.
"Damn," he said.
After a while, he looked up. He turned to J.C.
"You want to play him?"
"No, sir. He's done made a believer out of me."
"I know the feeling. He's beat me like a rented mule."
He looked at the wall clock and picked up his cigar again and put it in his teeth.
"I'll play you one more," he said.
"Yes, sir,"
said John Grady. Socorro took off her apron and hung it up and stood at the door.
"Good night,"
she said.
"Night, Socorro."
J.C. rose from his chair.
"You all want some more coffee?"
They played. When John Grady took the black queen, J.C. pushed back his chair and got up.
"I've tried to tell you, son, there's a cold winter coming."
He crossed the kitchen and set his cup in the sink and went to the door.
"Night,"
he said. Mac sat quietly studying the board. The cigar lay dead in the ashtray.
"Night," said John Grady.
He pushed open the door and went out. The screen door flapped shut. The clock ticked. Mac leaned back. He picked up the cigar stub and then he put it back in the ashtray.
"I believe I'll concede," he said.
"You could still win."
Mac looked at him.
"Bullshit," he said.
John Grady shrugged. Mac looked at the clock. He looked at John Grady. Then he leaned and carefully turned the board around. John Grady moved Mac's remaining black knight. Mac pursed his lips. He studied the board. He moved. 5 moves later, John Grady mated the white king. Mac shook his head.
"Let's go to bed," he said.
"Yes, sir."
He began to put away the pieces. Mac pushed back his chair and picked up the cups.
"What time did Troy and Billy say they'd be back?"
"I don't reckon they said."
"How come you not to go with them?"
I just thought I'd stick around here.
Mac carried the cups to the sink. Did they ask you to go?
Yes, sir. I don't need to go everywhere they go.
He slid the cover shut on the box and folded the board and rose. Is Troy fixing to go down there and go to work for his brother?
I don't know, sir.
He crossed the room and put the chess set back in the press and closed the door and got his hat.
You don't know or you ain't saying?
I don't know. If I wasn't saying, I'd have said so.
I know you would.
Sir.
Yes.
I feel kind of bad about Delbert.
What do you feel bad about?
Well, I guess I feel like I took his job.
Well, you didn't. He'd have been gone anyways.
Yes, sir.
You let me run the place, all right?
Yes, sir. Good night, sir.
Switch on the barn light yonder.
I can see all right.
You could see better with the light on.
Yes, sir. Well, it bothers the horses.
Bothers the horses?
Yes, sir.
He put on his hat and pushed open the door. Mac watched him cross the yard. Then he switched off the kitchen light and turned and crossed the room and went up the hallway.
Bothers the horses, he said. Damn.
When he got up in the morning and went down to Billy's room to wake him, Billy wasn't there. The bed looked slept in, and he limped out past the horse stalls and looked across the yard toward the kitchen. Then he went around to the side of the barn where the truck was parked. Billy was sitting in the seat, leaning over the steering wheel, taking the screws out of the metal sash frame that held the windshield and dropping the screws into the ashtray.
"Morning, cowboy," he said.
"Morning. What happened to the windshield?"
"Al."
"Al?
Al."
He took the last screws out and pried up and lifted away the frame and began to pry the edges of the caved-in glass out of the rubber molding with the blade of the screwdriver.
"Walk around and push in on this thing from the outside. Wait a minute, there's some gloves here."
John Grady pulled on the gloves and hobbled around and pushed on the edges of the glass while Billy pried with the screwdriver. They got the glass worked out of the molding along the bottom and one side, and then Billy borrowed the gloves and pulled the whole thing out in one piece and lifted it over the steering wheel and laid it in the floor of the truck on the passenger side.
"What did you do, drive with your head out the window?"
"No, I just sort of sat in the middle and looked out the good side."
He pushed at the windshield wiper lying inside across the dashboard.
"I thought maybe you'd not got in yet."
"We got in around 5. What did you do?"
"Nothing much."
"You ain't been rodeoing in the barn while I was gone, have you?"
"Nope."
"How's your foot?"
"It's all right."
Billy pushed the wiper up on its spring and pried the wiper arm off the capstan with the screwdriver and laid it on the seat.
"You going to get a new glass for it?"
"I'll get Joaquin to bring one when he goes in. I don't want the old man to see it if I can help it."
"Hell, anybody could run into an owl."
"I know, but anybody didn't."
John Grady was leaning through the open window of the standing truck door. He turned and spat and leaned some more.
"Well," he said, "I don't know what that means."
Billy laid the screwdriver in the seat.
"I don't either," he said. "I don't know why I said it. Let's go in and see if she's got breakfast ready. I could eat the running gears of a bull moose."
When they sat down, Orrin looked up from his paper and studied John Grady over the tops of his glasses.
"How's your foot?" he said.
"It's all right."
"I'll bet."
"It's all right enough to ride a horse, that's what you wanted to know, isn't it?"
"Can you get that in a stirrup?"
"I don't have to."
Orrin went back to his paper. They ate. After a while, he put the paper down and took off his glasses and laid them on the table.
"There's a man sending a 2-year filly out here that he aims to give to his wife. I kept my own counsel on that. He don't know nothing about the horse other than its blood, or any other horse, I reckon, probably you could say."
"Is she broke?"
"The wife or the horse?" "I'll lay 8 to 5 they ain't either one," said J.C., "sight unseen."
"I don't know," said Orrin. "Green broke or some kind of broke. He wants to leave her here 2 weeks. I said we'd give her all the training she was capable of absorbing in that length of time, and he seemed satisfied with that."
"All right. Billy, are you all working with us this week?"
"I reckon."
What time did the man say they'd be here? Said John Grady.
He said after breakfast. J.C., you all ready?
I was born that way.
Well, the day advanceth, said Orrin.
He put his glasses in his shirt pocket and pushed back his chair. They pulled into the yard in a pickup truck towing a new single trailer at about 8:30. John Grady walked out to meet them. The trailer was painted black and had the name of a ranch somewhere up in New Mexico that he'd never heard of painted on the side in gold. The two men unlatching and taking down the gate on the trailer nodded at him, and the taller of the two looked briefly around the yard, and then they backed the horse down the ramp.
"Where's Orrin at?" the tall man said.
John Grady watched the filly. She had a nervous look to her, which was all right for a young mare offloaded onto strange terrain. He limped around to see her from the other side. Her eye followed him. "Walk her around."
"What?"
"Walk her around."
"Is Orrin here?"
"No, sir, he's not. I'm the trainer. Just walk her around a minute and let me watch her." The man stood for a minute. Then he handed the halter rope to the other man.
"Walk her around some there, Lewis."
He looked at John Grady. John Grady was watching the filly.
"What time you expect him back?"
"Not till this evening." They watched the little filly walk up and back.
"Are you the trainer, sure enough?"
"Yes, sir."
"What is it you're looking for?"
John Grady studied the filly and he looked at the man. "That horse is lame," he said.
"Lame?"
"Yes, sir."
"Shit,"
the man said. The man walking the horse looked back over his shoulder.
"Did you hear that, Lewis?"
the man called to him.
"Yeah, I heard it. You want to just go on and shoot her?"
"What makes you think that horse is lame?" the man said.
"Well, sir, it's not really a matter of what I think. She's lame in the left foreleg. Let me look at her."
"Bring her over here, Lewis."
"You reckon she can make it that far?"
"I don't know."
He brought the horse over, and John Grady walked up to her and leaned against her with his shoulder and lifted her foreleg between his knees and examined the hoof. He ran his thumb around the frog, and he examined the hoof wall. He leaned against the animal to feel her breathing, and he talked to her and pulled his kerchief from his back pocket and wet it with spittle and began to clean the wall of the hoof.
"Who put this on here?" he said.
"Put what?"
"This dressing."
He held up the handkerchief to show them the stain from the hoof.
"I don't know," the man said.
John Grady took out his pocket knife and opened it and ran the point of it down the side wall of the hoof. The man had come closer to watch him. He held up the knife blade. "See that?" he said.
"Yeah?"
"She's got a sand crack in that hoof, and somebody has filled it in with wax and then put that hoof dressing over it." He rose and let the filly's foot down and stroked her shoulder, and the three of them stood looking at the filly. The tall man put his hands in his back pockets. He turned and spat.
"Well,"
he said. The man holding the horse toed the ground and looked away.
"The old man will shit when he hears this."
"Where did you all buy her at?" The man took one hand out of his back pocket and adjusted his hat. He looked at John Grady, and he looked at the filly again.
"Can I leave her with you?"
he said.
"No, sir." "Well, let me leave her here till Orrin gets back, and me and him can talk about it."
"I can't do that."
"Why not?"
"I can't do it."
"You're telling me to load her and get her off the place."
John Grady didn't answer. He didn't take his eyes off the man, either.
"You can do better than that," the man said.
"I don't believe I can." He looked at the man holding the horse. He looked toward the house, and he looked at John Grady again. Then he reached to his hip and took out his wallet and opened it and took out a $10 bill and folded the bill and put the wallet back and tendered the bill toward the boy.
"Here," he said, "put that in your pocket and don't tell nobody where you got it."
"I don't believe I can do that."
"Go on."
"No, sir." The man's face darkened. He stood holding out the bill. Then he stuck it in the pocket of his shirt.
"It wouldn't be no skin off your ass."
John Grady didn't answer. The man turned and spat again. I didn't have nothing to do with doctoring it that away, if that's what you're thinking.
I never said you did.
You wouldn't help a man out, though, would you?
Not that way, I wouldn't.
The man stood looking at John Grady. He spat once more. He looked at the other man, and he looked out across the spread.
Let's go, Carl, the other man said. Hell.
They walked the horse back across the lot toward the truck and trailer. John Grady stood watching them. They loaded the horse and raised the gate and shut the doors and latched them. The tall man walked around the side of the truck.
Hey, kid, he called.
Yes, sir.
You go to hell.
John Grady didn't answer.
You hear me?
Yes, sir, I hear you.
Then they got in the truck and turned and drove out across the lot and down the drive. He dropped the reins of his horse in the yard at the kitchen door and went in. Socorro was not in the kitchen, and he called her and waited and then went back out. As he was mounting the horse, she came to the door. She put her hands to her eyes against the sun.
Bueno, she said.
¿A qué hora regresa el señor Mac?
No sé.
He nodded. She watched him. She asked him what time he would be back, and he said by dark.
Espérate,
she said.
¿Está bien?
No, espérate.
She went in. He sat the horse. The horse stamped at the bare ground and shook its head.
All right, he said, we're going.
When she came back out, she had his lunch done up in a cloth, and she handed it up to him at the stirrup. He thanked her and reached behind him and put it in the game pocket of his ducking jacket and nodded and put the horse forward. She watched him ride to the gate and lean and undo the latch and push the gate open horseback and ride through and turn the horse and close the gate horseback and then set off down the road at a jog with the morning sun on his shoulders, his hat pushed back. Sitting very straight in the saddle, the wrapped and bootless foot at one side, the empty stirrup, the Herefords and their calves following along the fence and calling after him. He rode among the half-wild cattle in the Bransford pasture all day, and a cold wind blew down from the mountains of New Mexico. The cattle trotted off before him or ran with their tails up over the gravel plains among the creosote, and he studied them for culls as they went. He was horse training as much as he was sorting cattle, and the little blue horse he rode had the cutting horse's contempt for cows and would close herd them along the cross fence and bite them. John Grady gave him his head, and he cut out a big yearling calf, and John Grady roped the calf and dallied, but the calf didn't go down. The little horse stood, spraddle-legged, backed into the rope with the calf standing and twisting at the end of it.
"What do you want to do now?" he asked the horse.
The horse turned and backed. The calf went bucking.
I guess you think I'm going to get down and flank that big son of a bitch, and me on one leg.
He waited until the calf had bucked itself into a clear space among the creosote, and then he put the horse forward at a gallop. He paid the slack rope over the horse's head and overtook the calf on its off side. The calf went trotting. The rope ran from its neck along the ground on the near side and trailed in a curve behind its legs and ran forward up the offside following the horse. John Grady checked his dally and then stood in one stirrup and cleared his other leg of the trailing rope. When the rope snapped taut, it jerked the calf's head backward and snatched its hind legs from under it. The calf turned endwise in the air and slammed to the ground in a cloud of dust and lay there. John Grady was already off the horse and hobbling back along the rope to where the calf lay, and he knelt on its head before it could recover and grabbed its hind leg and yanked the piggin string from his belt and tied it and waited till it quit struggling. Then he leaned and pulled the leg up to take a closer look at the swelling on the inside of its leg that had made it run oddly and caused him to cut it out and rope it in the first place. The calf had a stob of wood embedded under the skin. He tried to get hold of it with his fingers, but it was broken off almost flush. He felt along the length of it and pushed on the end of it with his thumb and tried to feed it forward. He got a bit more of it exposed and finally leaned forward and got hold of it with his teeth and pulled it out. A watery serum ran. He held the stick under his nose and sniffed it and then pitched it away and went back to the horse to get his bottle of Peerless and his swabs. When he turned the calf loose, it was running worse than before, but he thought it would be all right.
He ate his lunch at noon in an outcropping of lava rock with a view across the floodplain to the north and to the west. There were ancient pictographs among the rocks, engravings of animals and moons and men and lost hieroglyphics whose meaning no man would ever know. The rocks were warm in the sun, and he sat sheltered from the wind and watched the silent, empty land. Nothing moved. After a while, he folded away the wrappings from his lunch and rose and went down and caught the horse. He was still currying the sweated animal by the light from the barn stall when Billy walked down, picking his teeth, and stood watching him.
Where'd you go?
Cedar Springs.
You up there all day?
Yeah.
The man called and owned that filly.
I figured he would.
He wasn't pissed off or nothing.
He had no reason to be.
He asked Mac if he could get you to look at some horses for him.
Well, he moved along the horse, brushing. Billy watched him.
She says she's fixing to throw it out if you don't come.
I'll be there in a minute.
All right.
What did you think about that country down there?
I thought it was some pretty nice country.
Yeah?
I ain't going nowhere. Troy ain't either.
John Grady ran the brush down the horse's loins. The horse shuddered. Well, I'll be going somewhere when the army takes this spread over.
Yeah, I know it.
Troy ain't leaving? Billy looked at the end of his toothpick and put it back in his mouth. The shadow of a bat come to hunt in the barn light passed across the horse, across John Grady.
I think he just wanted to see his brother.
John Grady nodded. He leaned with both forearms across the horse and stripped the loose hairs from the brush and watched them drop. When he entered the kitchen, Orrin was still at the table. He looked up from his paper and then went back to reading. John Grady went to the sink and washed, and Socorro opened the warmer door over the oven and got down a plate. He sat eating his supper and reading the news on the backside of Orrin's paper across the table.
"What's a plebiscite?" said Orrin.
"You got me."
After a while, Orrin said, "Don't be reading the back of the paper."
"What?"
"I said, don't be reading the back of the paper."
"All right."
He folded the paper and slid it across the table and raised his coffee and sipped it.
"How did you know I was reading the back of the paper?" "I could feel it."
"What's wrong with it?"
"Nothing. It just makes me nervous, is all. It's a bad habit people got. If you want to read a man's paper, you ought to ask him."
"All right."
"The man that owned that filly you wouldn't have on the property called out here trying to hire you."
"I already got a job."
"I think he just wanted you to ride out to Fabian's with him to look at a horse."
John Grady nodded.
"That ain't what he wants."
Orrin watched him.
"That's what Mac said."
"Or it ain't all he wants."
Orrin lit a cigarette and laid the pack back on the table. John Grady ate.
"What did Mac say?"
"Said he'd tell you."
"Well, I've been told."
"Hell, call the man. You could do a little horse trading on the weekend. Make yourself some money."
"I guess I don't know how to work for but one man at a time."
Orrin smoked. He watched the boy.
"Went up to Cedar Springs, worked them scrubs up there."
"I wasn't asking."
"I know it. I took that little blue horse of Watson's."
"How'd he do?"
"I thought he'd done awful good. Not bragging or nothing, he was a good horse before I ever put a saddle on him."
"You could have bought that horse."
"I know it."
"What didn't you like about him?"
"There wasn't nothing I didn't like about him."
"You won't buy him now?"
"Nope."
He finished eating and wiped his plate with the last piece of tortilla and ate that and pushed the plate back and drank his coffee and set the cup down and looked at Orrin.
"He's just a good all-around horse. He ain't a finished horse, but I think he'll make a kind of horse."
"I'm pleased to hear it.
Of course, your preference is for one that'll bow up like a bandsaw and run headfirst into the barn wall." John Grady smiled.
"Horse of my dreams," he said. "It ain't exactly like that."
"How is it, then?"
"I don't know. I think it's just something you like or don't like. You can add up all of a horse's good points on a sheet of paper, and it still won't tell you whether you like the horse or not."
"What about if you add up all his bad ones?"
I don't know. I'd say you'd probably done made up your mind at that point.
You think there's horses so spoiled you can't do nothing with them?
Yes, I do, but probably not as many as you might think.
Maybe not. You think a horse can understand what a man says?
You mean like the words?
I don't know, like he can understand what he says.
John Grady looked out the window. Water was beaded on the glass. Two bats were hunting in the barn light.
No, he said. I think he can understand what you mean.
He watched the bats. He looked at Orin.
I guess my feeling about a horse is that he mostly worries about what he don't know. He likes to be able to see you. Barring that, he likes to be able to hear you. Maybe he thinks that if you're talking, you won't be doing something else he don't know about.
Do you think horses think?
Sure, don't you?
Yes, I do. Some people claim they don't.
Well, some people could be wrong.
You think you can tell what a horse is thinking?
I think I can tell what he's fixing to do.
Generally.
John Grady smiled.
Yeah, he said, generally.
Mac always claimed a horse knows the difference between right and wrong.
Mac's right.
Orin smoked.
Well, he said, that's always been a bit much for me to swallow.
I think if they didn't, you couldn't even train one.
You don't think it's just getting them to do what you want?
I think you can train a rooster to do what you want,
but you won't have him. There's a way to train a horse where when you get done, you've got the horse, on his own ground. A good horse will figure things out on his own. You can see what's in his heart. He won't do one thing while you're watching him and another when you ain't. He's all of a piece. When you've got a horse to that place, you can't hardly get him to do something he knows is wrong. He'll fight you over it. And if you mistreat him, it just about kills him. A good horse has justice in his heart. I've seen it.
You got a lot higher opinion of horses than I got, Orin said.
I really don't have all that much in the way of opinions where horses are concerned. When I was a kid, I thought I knew all there was to know about a horse. Where horses are concerned, I've just got dumber and dumber.
Orin smiled.
If a man really understood horses, John Grady said, if a man really understood horses, he could just about train one by looking at it. There wouldn't be nothing to it.
My way is a long way from working one over with a trace chain, but it's a long way from what's possible, too.
He stretched his legs out. He crossed the sprained foot over his boot.
You're right about one thing, he said. They're mostly ruined before they ever bring them out here. They're ruined at the first saddle, before that even. The best horses are the ones been around kids, or maybe even just a wild horse in off the range that's never even seen a man. He's got nothing to unlearn.
You might have a hard time getting anyone to agree with you on that last one.
I know it.
You ever break a wild horse?
Yeah. You hardly ever train one, though.
Why not?
People don't want them trained. They just want them broke. You got to train the owner.
Orin leaned and stubbed out his cigarette.
I hear you, he said.
John Grady sat studying the smoke rising into the lampshade over the table.
That probably ain't true what I said about the one that ain't never seen a man. They need to see people. They need to just see them around. Maybe what they need is to just think people are trees until the trainer comes along.
It was still light out, a gray light with the rain falling in the streets again and the vendors huddled in the doorways looking out at the rain without expression. He stomped the water from his boots and entered and crossed to the bar and took off his hat and laid it on the bar stool. There were no other customers. Two whores lounging on a sofa watched him without much interest. The barman poured his whiskey. He described the girl to the barman, but the barman only shrugged and shook his head.
Eres muy joven.
He shrugged again. He wiped the bar and leaned back and took a cigarette from his shirt pocket and lit it. John Grady motioned for another whiskey and doled his coins onto the counter. He took his hat and his glass over to the sofa and queried the whores, but they only tugged at his clothing and asked him to buy them a drink. He looked into their faces. Who they might be behind the caked sizing and the rouge, the black grease paint lining their dark Indian eyes.
They seemed alien and sad, like madwomen dressed for an outing. He looked at the neon deer hanging on the wall behind them and the garish tapestries of plush, of foil and braid. He could hear the rain on the roof to the rear and the steady small drip of water falling from the ceiling into puddles in the blood-red carpeting. He drained his whiskey and set the glass on the low table and put on his hat. He nodded to them and touched the brim of his hat to go.
Hoven, said the eldest.
See. She looked furtively about, but there was no one there to hear.
Ya no está, she said.
He asked where she had gone, but they did not know. He asked if she would return, but they did not think so. He touched his hat again.
Gracias, he said.
Andale,
said the horse. At the corner, a sturdy cab driver in a blue suit of polished serge hailed him. He held an antique umbrella, rare to see in that country. One of the panels between the ribs had been replaced by a sheet of blue cellophane, and under it the driver's face was blue. He asked John Grady if he wanted to go see the girls, and he said that he did. They drove through the flooded and potholed streets. The driver was slightly drunk and commented freely on pedestrians that crossed before them or that stood in the doorways. He commented on aspects of their character deducible from their appearance. He commented on crossing dogs. He talked about what the dogs thought and where they might be going and why. They sat at a whorehouse bar on the outskirts of the city, and the driver pointed out the virtues of the various whores that were in the room. He said that men out for an evening were often likely to accept the first proposal, but that the prudent man would be more selective, that he would not be misled by appearances. He said that it was best to move freely where whores were concerned. He said that in a healthy society, choice should always be the prerogative of the buyer. He turned to regard the boy with dreamy eyes.
De acuerdo, he said.
Claro que sí, said John Grady.
They drank up and moved on. Outside it was dark, and in the streets the colored lights lay slurred and faintly peened in the fine rain. They sat at the bar of an establishment called the Red Cock. The driver saluted with his glass aloft and drank. They studied the whores.
I can take you some other places, the driver said. Maybe she's go home.
Maybe.
Maybe she's get married. Sometimes these girls is get married.
I seen her down here 2 weeks ago.
The driver reflected. He sat smoking. John Grady finished his drink and rose.
Vamos a regresar a la venada, he said.
In the Calle de Santos de Goyado, he sat at the bar and waited. After a while, the driver returned and leaned and whispered to him, and then looked about with studied caution.
You must talk to Manolo. Manolo only can give us this information.
Where is he?
I take you to him. I take you. It is arranged. You have to pay.
John Grady reached for his wallet. The driver stayed his arm. He looked toward the barman.
Afuera, he said. No podemos hacerlo aquí.
Outside, he again reached for his billfold, but the driver said for him to wait. He looked about theatrically.
He's peligroso,
he hissed. They got into the cab.
Where is he? Said John Grady.
We go to him now. I take you.
He started the engine, and they pulled away down the street and turned right. They drove halfway up the block and turned again and pulled into an alley and parked. The driver cut the engine and switched off the lights. They sat in the darkness. They could hear a radio in the distance. They could hear rainwater from the canales dripping in the puddles in the alley. After a while, a man appeared and opened the rear door of the cab and got in. The dome light was out in the cab, and John Grady could not see the man's face. He was smoking a cigarette, and he cupped his hand over it when he smoked in the manner of country people. John Grady could smell the cologne he wore.
Bueno, the man said. You pay him now, said the cab driver. He will tell you where the girl is.
How much do I pay him?
You pay me $50, the man said.
$50?
No one answered.
I don't have $50.
The man sat for a moment. Then he opened the door again and got out.
Wait a minute, said John Grady.
The man stood in the alley, one hand on the door.
John Grady could see him. He was wearing a black suit and a black tie. His face was small and wedge-shaped.
"Do you know this girl?" said John Grady.
"Of course I know this girl. You waste my time."
"What does she look like?"
"She's 16 years old. She's the epileptica. There is only one. She's gone 2 weeks now. You waste my time. You have no money and you waste my time."
"I'll get the money. I'll bring it tomorrow night."
The man looked at the driver.
"I'll come to the Venada. I'll bring it to the Venada."
The man turned his head slightly and spat and turned back.
"You can't come to the Venada on this business. What is the matter with you? How much do you have?"
John Grady took out his billfold.
30-something, he said.
He thumbed through the bills.
$36.
The man held out his hand.
"Give it to me."
John Grady handed him the money. He wadded it into his shirt pocket without even looking at it.
"The White Lake," he said.
Then he shut the door and was gone. They couldn't even hear his footsteps going back up the alley. The driver turned in his seat.
"Do you want to go to the White Lake?"
"I don't have any more money."
The driver drummed his fingers on the back of the seat.
"Do you not have no monies?"
"No."
The driver shook his head.
"No monies," he said. "Okay. Do you want to go back to the Avenida?"
"I can't pay you."
"It's okay."
He started the engine and backed down the alley toward the street.
"You pay me next time, okay?"
"Okay."
"Okay."
When he passed Billy's room, the light was on, and he stopped and pushed open the canvas and looked in. Billy was lying in bed. He lowered the book he was reading and looked over the top of it and then laid it down.
"What are you reading?"
"Destry, where you been?"
"You ever been to a place called the White Lake?"
"Yes, I have, one time."
"Is it real expensive?"
"It's real expensive. Why?"
"I was just wondering about it. See you in the morning."
He let the canvas fall and turned and went on down the bay to his room.
"You better stay out of the White Lake, son," Billy called.
John Grady pushed open the curtain and felt for the light chain.
"It ain't no place for a cowboy."
He found the chain and pulled the light on.
"You hear me?"
He limped down the hallway after breakfast with his hat in his hand.
"Mr. Mack?"
he called. McGovern came to the door of his office. He had some papers in his hand and some more wedged under his elbow.
"Come on in, son," he said.
John Grady stood in the door. Mack was at his desk.
"Come on in," he said. "What do you need that I ain't got?"
He looked up from his papers. John Grady was still standing in the doorway.
"I wonder if I could draw some on next month's pay."
Mack reached for his billfold.
"How much did you need?"
"Well, I'd like to get 100 if I could."
Mack looked at him.
"You can have it if you want," he said. "What did you aim to do next month?"
"I'll make out."
He opened the billfold and counted out 5 twenties.
"Well," he said, "I guess you're big enough to handle your own affairs. It ain't none of my business, is it?"
"I just needed it for something."
"All right."
He shuffled the bills together and leaned and laid them on the desk. John Grady came in and picked them up and folded them and stuck them in his shirt pocket.
"Thank you," he said.
"That's all right. How's your foot?"
"It's doing good."
"You're still favoring it, I see."
"It's all right."
"You still intend to trade for that horse?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"How did you know Wolfenbarger's filly had a bad hoof?"
"I could see it."
"She didn't walk lame."
"No, sir, it was her ear."
"Her ear?"
"Yes, sir, every time that foot hit the ground, one ear would move a little. I just kept watching her."
"Sort of like a poker tell."
"Yes, sir, sort of."
"You didn't want to go off horse trading with the old man, though."
"No, sir. Is he a friend of yours?"
"I know him. Why?"
"Nothing."
"What were you going to say?"
"That's all right."
"You can say it. Go ahead."
"Well, I guess I was going to say that I didn't think I could keep him out of trouble on no part-time basis."
"Like it would be a full-time job."
"I didn't say that."
Mack shook his head.
"Get your butt out of here,"
he said.
Yes, sir.
You didn't tell him that, did you?
No, sir, I ain't talked to him.
Well, that's a shame.
Yes, sir.
He put on his hat and turned, but he stopped again at the door.
Thank you, sir.
Go on, it's your money.
When he came in that evening, Socorro had already left the kitchen, and there was no one at the table except the old man. He was smoking a home-rolled cigarette and listening to the news on the radio. John Grady got his plate and his coffee and set them on the table and pulled back the chair and sat.
"Evening, Mr. Johnson," he said.
"Evening, son.
What's the news?"
The old man shook his head. He leaned across the table to the windowsill where the radio sat and turned it off.
"It ain't news no more," he said. "Wars and rumors of wars. I don't know why I listen to it. It's an ugly habit, and I wish I could get broke of it, but I think it'd just get worse."
John Grady spooned pico de gallo over his rice and his flautas and rolled up a tortilla and commenced to eat. The old man watched him. He nodded at the boy's boots.
"You look like you've been in some pretty miry country today."
"Yes, sir, I was. Some."
"That old greasy clay is hard to clean off of anything. Oliver Lee always said he'd come out here because the country was so sorry nobody else would have it and he'd be left alone. Of course he was wrong, at least about being left alone."
"Yes, sir, I guess he was."
"How's your foot doing?"
"It's all right."
The old man smiled. He drew on his cigarette and tapped the ash into the ashtray on the table.
"Don't be fooled by the good rains we've had. This country's fixing to dry up and blow away."
"How do you know?"
"It just is."
"You want some more coffee?"
"No, thanks."
The boy got up and went to the stove and filled his cup and came back.
"Country's overdue," the old man said. "Folks have got short memories. They might be glad to let the army have it before they're done."
The boy ate.
"How much do you think the army will take?"
The old man drew on his cigarette and stubbed it out thoughtfully.
"I think they'll take the whole Tularosa Basin. That's my guess."
"Can they just take it?"
"Yeah, they can take it. Folks will piss and moan about it, but they don't have a choice. They ought to be glad to get shut of it."
"What do you think Mr. Prather will do?"
"John Prather will do whatever he says he'll do."
"Mr. Mack said he told him the only way he'd leave was in a box."
"Then that's how he'll leave. You can take that to the bank."
John Grady wiped his plate and sat back with his cup of coffee.
"I ought not to ask you this," he said.
"Ask it."
"You don't have to answer."
"I know it."
"Who do you think killed Colonel Fountain?"
The old man shook his head. He sat for a long time.
"I ought not to have asked you."
"No, it's all right. You know, his daughter's name was Maggie, too. She was the one told Fountain to take the boy with him. Said they wouldn't bother an 8-year-old boy. But she was wrong, wasn't she?"
"Yes, sir."
"A lot of people think Oliver Lee killed him. I knew Oliver pretty well. We was the same age. He had 4 sons himself. I just don't believe it."
"You don't think he could have done it?"
"I'll say it's stronger than that. I'll say he didn't."
"Or cause it to be done?"
"Well, that's another matter. I'll say he never shed no tears over it, over the colonel, leastways."
"You didn't want some more coffee?"
"No, thank you, son. I'd be up all night."
"Do you think they're still buried out there somewheres?"
"No, I don't."
"What do you think happened?"
"I always thought the bodies were taken to Mexico. They had a choice to bury them out there somewhere south of the pass where they might be discovered, or to go another 30 miles to where they could drop them off the edge of the world, and I think that's what they done."
John Grady nodded. He sipped his coffee.
"Were you ever in a shooting scrape?"
"I was, one time. I was old enough to know better, too."
"Where was it?"
"Down on the river east of Clint. It was in 1917, just before my brother died, and we were on the wrong side of the river waiting for dark to cross some stolen horses we'd recovered, and we got word they was laying for us. We waited and waited, and after a while the moon come up, just a piece of a moon, not even a quarter. It come up behind us, and we could see it reflected in the windshield of their car over in the trees along the river breaks. Wendell Williams looked at me, and he said, 'We got 2 moons in the sky. I don't believe I ever seen that before.' And I said, 'Yes, and one of them is backwards.' And we opened fire on them with our rifles."
Did they shoot back?
Sure they did. We laid there and shot up about a box of shells apiece, and then they left out.
Was anybody hit?
Not that I ever heard of. We hit the car a time or two, knocked the windshield out.
Did you get the horses across?
We did.
How many head was it?
It was a few, about 70 head.
That's a lot of horses.
It was a lot of horses. We was paid good money, too. But it wasn't worth getting shot over.
No, sir, I guess not.
It does funny things to a man's head.
What's that, sir?
Being shot at. Having dirt thrown on you, leaves cut. It changes a man's perspective. Maybe some might have an appetite for it. I never did.
You didn't fight in the Revolution?
No.
You were down there, though.
Yes, trying to get the hell out. I'd been down there too long. I was just as glad when it did start. You'd wake up in some little town on a Sunday morning, and they'd be out in the street shooting at one another. You couldn't make any sense out of it. We like to never got out of there. I saw terrible things in that country. I dreamt about them for years.
He leaned and put his elbows on the table and took his makings from his shirt pocket and rolled another smoke and lit it. He sat looking at the table. He talked for a long time. He named the towns and villages, the mud pueblos, the executions against the mud walls sprayed with new blood over the dried black of the old and the fine powdered clay sifting down from the bullet holes in the wall after the men had fallen, and the slow drift of rifle smoke, and the corpses stacked in the streets or piled into the wooden-wheeled carretas trundling over the cobbles or over the dirt roads to the nameless graves. There were thousands who went to war in the only suit they owned, suits in which they'd been married and in which they would be buried. Standing in the streets in their coats and ties and hats behind the upturned carts and bales and firing their rifles like irate accountants. And the small artillery pieces on wheels that scooted backwards in the street at every round and had to be retrieved. And the endless riding of horses to their deaths bearing flags or banners or the tent-like tapestries painted with portraits of the Virgin carried on poles into battle as if the Mother of God herself were authoress of all that calamity and mayhem and madness. The tall case clock in the hallway chimed 10.
I reckon I'd better get on to bed, the old man said.
Yes, sir.
He rose.
I don't much like to, he said, but there ain't no help for it.
Good night, sir.
Good night.
The cab driver would see him through the wrought iron gate and the high brick wall and up the walk to the doorway, as if the surrounding dark that formed the outskirts of the city were a danger, or the desert plains beyond. He pulled a velvet bell pull in an alcove in the archway and stood back, humming. He looked at John Grady.
Do you like for me to wait? I can wait.
No, it's all right.
The door opened. A hostess in evening attire smiled at them and stood back and held the door. John Grady entered and took off his hat, and the woman spoke with the driver and then shut the door and turned. She held out her hand, and John Grady reached for his hip pocket. She smiled.
Your hat, she said.
He handed her his hat, and she gestured toward the room, and he turned and went in, brushing down his hair with the flat of his hand. There was a bar to the right up the two stairs, and he stepped up and passed along behind the stools where men were drinking and talking. The bar was mahogany and softly lit, and the barmen wore little burgundy jackets and bow ties. Out in the salon, the whores lounged on sofas of red damask and gold brocade. They wore negligees and floor-length formal gowns and sheath dresses of white satin or purple velvet that were split up the thigh, and they wore shoes of glass or gold and sat in studied poses with their red mouths pouting in the gloom. A cut-glass chandelier hung overhead, and on a dais to the right a string trio was playing. He walked to the far end of the bar. When he put his hand on the rail, the barman was already there, placing a napkin.
Good evening, sir, he said.
Evening. I'll have an old granddad and water back.
Yes, sir.
The barman moved away. John Grady put his boot on the polished brass foot rail, and he watched the whores in the glass of the back bar. The men at the bar were mostly well-dressed Mexicans, with a few Americans dressed in flowered shirts of an intemperately thin cloth.
A tall woman in a diaphanous gown passed through the salon like the ghost of a whore. A cockroach that had been moving along the counter behind the bottles ascended to the glass where it encountered itself and froze. He ordered another drink. The barman poured. When he looked into the glass again, she was sitting by herself on a dark velvet couch with her gown arranged about her and her hands composed in her lap. He reached for his hat, not taking his eyes from her. He called for the barman.
La cuenta, por favor.
He looked down. He remembered that he'd left his hat with the hostess at the door. He took out his wallet and pushed a $5 bill across the mahogany and folded the rest of the bills and put them in his shirt pocket. The barman brought the change and he pushed a dollar back toward him and turned and looked across the room to where she sat. She looked small and lost. She sat with her eyes closed, and he realized that she was listening to the music. He poured the shot of whiskey into the glass of water and set the shot glass on the bar and took his drink and set out across the room. His faint shadow under the lights of the great glass tiara above them may have brought her from her reveries. She looked up at him and smiled thinly with her painted child's mouth. He almost reached for his hat brim.
Hello, he said. You care if I sit down?
She recomposed herself and smoothed her skirt to make room on the couch beside her. A waiter moved out from the shadows along the walls and laid down two napkins on the low glass table before them and stood.
Bring me an old granddad and water back, and whatever she's drinking.
He nodded and moved away. John Grady looked at the girl. She leaned forward and smoothed her skirt again.
Lo siento, she said. Pero no hablo inglés.
Está bien. Podemos hablar español.
Oh, she said. Qué bueno.
¿Qué es su nombre?
Magdalena. ¿Y usted?
He didn't answer. Magdalena, he said. She looked down, as if the sound of her name were troubling to her.
¿Es su nombre de pila? He said.
Sí, por supuesto.
No es su nombre profesional.
She put her hand to her mouth.
Oh, she said. No, es mi nombre propio.
He watched her. He told her that he had seen her at La Venada, but she only nodded and did not seem surprised. The waiter arrived with the drinks and he paid for them and tipped the man a dollar. She did not pick up her drink then or later. She spoke so softly he had to lean to catch her words. She said that the other women were watching, but that it was nothing. It was only that she was new to this place. He nodded.
No importa, he said.
She asked why he had not spoken to her at La Venada. He said that it was because he was with friends. She asked him if he had a sweetheart at La Venada, but he said that he did not.
No me recuerda, he said.
She shook her head. She looked up. They sat in silence.
¿Cuántos años tiene?
He said.
Bastantes.
He said it was all right if she did not wish to say, but she didn't answer. She smiled wistfully. She touched his sleeve.
Fue mentira, she said. Lo que decía.
¿Cómo?
She said that it was a lie that she did not remember him. She said that he was standing at the bar and she thought that he would come talk to her, but that he had not, and when she looked again, he was gone.
¿Verdad?
Sí.
He said that she had not really lied. He said she'd only shook her head, but she shook her head again and said that these were the worst lies of all. She asked him why he had come to the White Lake alone, and he looked at the drinks untouched on the table before them, and he thought about that and about lies. And he turned and looked at her.
¿Por qué la andaba buscando?
He said.
Ya tengo tiempo buscándola.
She didn't answer.
¿Y cómo es que me recuerda?
She half turned away. She almost whispered.
También yo,
she said.
¿Mande?
She turned and looked at him.
También yo.
In the room, she turned and closed the door behind them. He couldn't even remember how they got there. He remembered her hand in his, small and cold, so strange to feel. The prism-broken light from the chandelier that ran in a river over her naked shoulders when they passed beneath, half-stumbling after her like a child. She went to the bedside and lit two candles and then turned off the lamp. He stood in the room with his hands at his sides. She reached to the back of her neck and undid the clasp of her gown and reached behind and pulled down the zipper. He began to unbutton his shirt. The room was small and the bed all but filled it. It was a four-post bed with a canopy and curtains of wine-colored organza, and the candles shone through onto the pillows with a winey light. There was a light knock at the door.
"Tenemos que pagar," she said.
He took the folded bills from his pocket.
"Para la noche," he said. "Es muy caro."
"¿Cuánto?" He was counting out the bills. He had $82. He held it out to her. She looked at the money and she looked at him. The knock came again.
"Dame 50," she said. "Es bastante?" "Sí, sí."
She took the money and opened the door and held it out and whispered to the man on the other side. He was tall and thin, and he smoked a cigarette in a silver holder, and he wore a black silk shirt. He looked at the client for just a moment through the partly open door, and he counted the money and nodded and turned away, and she shut the door. Her bare back was pale in the candlelight where the dress was open. Her black hair glistened. She turned and withdrew her arms from the sleeves of the dress and caught the front of it before her. She stepped from the pooled cloth and laid the dress across a chair and stepped behind the gauzy curtain.